From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
Here we made a film about powerful people holding sway over our public institutions, and the film itself was caught up in the undue influence of these powerful people in public media.
Filmmakers Tia Lesson and Carl Diehl talk about why their documentary, Citizen Coke, was dropped by public television. Then another pair of filmmakers who figured out how to market their small indie drama with a potato chip. But first on the News Banter, Aereo is a no-go and Paramount has big trouble in not-so-little China. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my fellow banterer, Michael Schneider of TV Guide magazine. How are you, Michael?
Hello, Kim. I'm good.
So, you know, there has been a lot said already about the Supreme Court's decision in the case involving Aereo. And this is that service that was going to allow you to, did allow you, if you lived in the right places, to watch the broadcast networks through your computer using these little dime-sized broadcasting antennas. And you could save a lot of money by doing that. You didn't have to pay a big cable bill to see those broadcast networks. But guess what? Aereo's going away.
Yeah, there was a lot of energy sort of devoted to stopping this at the networks, at the broadcasters. I always felt that Aereo was sort of a solution in search of a problem. No one is actually demanding to watch live streams of television stations on their devices. It's just not something people want to do. They want to stream original content. They want a time shift. They don't want to do this. But there's a larger issue at play, which is the broadcast networks, they see how antiquated their whole entire ecosystem is, and they know that technology is coming and changing, and they fear it. They don't know what the solution is. They're just afraid that this is the pathway to something that could actually disrupt their business.
Yeah, and so, then just to be clear, their business is that, you know, they get paid a lot of money by cable companies to carry CBS, ABC, Fox, the other broadcast networks, and that's money that they desperately want and need as audiences diminish. And so they were dead serious. I mean, they were turning cartwheels when the court said that Aereo was an illegal infringement on their copyrights.
Right, right. So basically, it's a stay of execution for television stations. But it ain't over yet. Technology is changing. People are finding new ways to telecast this kind of fare. And at some point, there is going to be a way for people to watch their shows streamed live on any device they want. And if the broadcast stations and networks don't get with the game and figure out just what the next technology is going to be, they're going to be left without any viewers.
Yeah, well, it's going to be it's slow, but definitely a progression in the wrong direction for them. Another example of that is a transformation in television news.
Right.
You know, it was announced this week Diane Sawyer is going to depart from ABC News, that David Muir, who's been working on weekends, is going to replace her. But what was notable is the old path by which George Stephanopoulos would move from the morning show to the evening news, and that was the big ascent that was so important to people in that kind of work. That's not happening.
Right. All the money is in the morning shows, so they're not about to take George Stephanopoulos away from Good Morning America, especially now that the Today Show is actually resurgent and is starting to really, again, assert some sort of ratings prowess. And GMA, which has been number one for the past year or two, is something that ABC wants to hold on to. And George there is garnering a much larger audience than he ever would in the evening news. And plus, he's just more valuable at 7 a.m. as opposed to 6:30 p.m. The evening news just isn't what it once was. Speaking of an antiquated system. People aren't watching it the way they used to. They still do watch it, but you know, there's a sense that the real money is in daytime, and that's the only way to, first off, pay for George Stephanopoulos' salary is to keep him there. So he's now the lead anchor. He's going to anchor all of their major news reports. He'll anchor all the political coverage, et cetera, going forward. So it's fascinating that David Muir has that nightly news job, and yet he's not their lead anchor.
Yeah, George, I think, probably maybe was hoping to sleep in, but it's not going to happen.
No.
Meanwhile, on the movie side of things, Transformers, this is the movie of the weekend now, the fourth one, Transformers Age of Extinction. Paramount has twisted itself into knots trying to make this film go in the very important, burgeoning, soon-to-be biggest market in the world of China. And this has been really kind of a case study of why China is so hard for Hollywood.
Yeah, well, you know, obviously China is the market that everyone wants to be in. That's why they make these kind of movies. This is why Michael Bay is still a sought-after movie maker because the last Transformers actually made $172 million in 2011 just in China alone. But at the same time, that marketplace is changing. There's a lot more endemic movies, a lot more Chinese movies that are doing quite well in that territory. Hollywood doesn't want to lose its grasp, but yet it's starting to. The number one movie in China this year is something called The Monkey King out of Hong Kong. So Hollywood knows they need to play nice, and unfortunately, it's not easy to play nice in China.
Yeah, I mean, the Chinese have really kept Hollywood at more than arm's length, and absolutely everyone and their brother and sister has made that trek to China looking for money and financing. Thomas Tull of Legendary Pictures said recently that, you know, this is the most difficult attempt to make deals that he has ever encountered in his career, and that anybody who thinks they have China figured out should give him a call and tell him how it works, because many people have gone over and thought that they were going to get a deal for a movie or a set of movies, some kind of financing, this or that. And almost invariably, it just doesn't seem to happen.
Well, they have all the leverage. I mean, they have over a billion people in China. I mean, they have all of the leverage. And the thing is, at some point, if you're Hollywood, if you still want to be in business with China, then you basically have to do whatever China wants.
And this is, of course, Paramount had a big last-minute panic when one of the companies that was supposed to have a product tie-in with this project, Penghu, a big hotel, suddenly said that Paramount had not delivered what it was supposed to deliver in terms of promoting the hotel, and they were going to try and block the release of the film, and the Paramount executives had to go scrambling. And
I wish I was there, Kim, to see Michael Bay, Rob Moore from Paramount, Lorenzo Di Bonaventura, all of them hopping into a tiny little executive jet, flying over to Beijing just to make nice, to do a press conference. They brought in a bumblebee, which is one of the key Transformers characters, to the hotel. Everyone's shaking hands.
Meanwhile, people here in this country are saying this was a shakedown, pure and simple, and that's the way it is when you're doing business in China. That's the allegation. So, you know, Paramount had to go make nice. I'm sure it made them sick to their stomachs, but, you know, what had to be done had to be done.
You want to play in China, you got to play by China's rules.
Let me just briefly turn to another country, Britain. The hacking trial, which we've talked about many times on the show, ended. Rebecca Brooks, the sort of so-called fifth daughter of Rupert Murdoch, walked away, which surprised many people. Her colleague, this is at the News of the World tabloids, which no longer exists, and this is all about, you know, alleged hacking and police bribery. Some of these cases still going on. He was convicted on one count. I think the key takeaway from our point of view is that the Scotland Yard people now say they want to question Rupert Murdoch and his son James, who was running that part of the business, and we'll see what nothing comes of that.
I've said it before, and I'll say it again. Rupert's going to get off scot-free in this case. People
Scotland
have already moved
Yard
on.
Free.
Exactly.
All right. Thank you, Michael.
Thanks, Kim.
That's Michael Schneider, executive editor of TV Guide magazine. If you watch public television, you've heard this.
This program was made possible by contributions to your PBS station from viewers like you. Thank you.
It's true that public media depends on donations from audience members, but also very desirable are big money gifts from wealthy philanthropists. Tia Lesson and Carl Diehl, who are Oscar-nominated filmmakers behind the 2008 documentary Trouble the Water, weren't thinking about that when they set out to make their latest film, Citizen Coke. They were focusing on the impact of the Supreme Court's ruling in the Citizens United case, that money is speech and the government can't limit political spending by corporations or unions. In Lesson and Diehl's new film, Ellen Weintraub of the Federal Election Commission describes the impact.
The court said that as long as it's independent spending, it can't be corrupting. Give the money directly to the candidate, you can't give more than $2,500 per election. Give the money to this super PAC out there that is advancing the goals of the same candidate, and you can give an unlimited amount of money, and some folks are giving millions.
One of those folks, as Lesson and Diehl were to learn, is David Koch, executive vice president of Koch Industries and a very active conservative. In the film Citizen Coke, Diehl and Lesson explore the controversies surrounding Wisconsin Republican Governor Scott Walker. And they found that David Koch and his brother Charles had been major players behind the scenes. Their super PAC, Americans for Prosperity, had given more than $3 million to help Walker fend off a recall effort. Filmmakers Lesson and Diehl were not aware that David Koch also sat on the board of WNET in New York, the largest public TV station in the country. They were simply thrilled that, based on a short reel, public television was going to finance and broadcast their movie through its independent television service, or ITVS. So you go to ITVS, and had you done stuff with them before? Had you ever done a project with them, or is this the first time?
No, we had never gotten a commission from ITVS. We never raised money from ITVS, and we were thrilled. You know, one of the important things that they do is they also curate a great program called Independent Lens, which is an amazing venue for documentary films on free television. And so for us, what was attractive more than anything was to have access to that free TV audience and to be part of this elite, wonderfully curated program.
Right, of course. So you have your six-minute preview. How much Coke is there in the six-minute preview?
Proportionately, probably more than there is in the final film.
as a ratio of footage to Coke.
I would say, you know, here's the thing. You know, when you're doing the reel, you're making it sexy. You're trying to raise money. And, you know, we used language in the reel that was sort of intended to capture people's interest that we didn't use in the final film. You know, for example, we title them in the reel Billionaire Extremists.
Was kind of edgier than what made it might have been in the final film.
Yeah, it was. But I don't think there was any doubt about what direction it was that we were heading. And at the end of the day, if you look at the final film and you look at the six-minute pitch reel that went around and that public television looked at, it's remarkably similar. I mean, I don't know how you would expect it to go any place other than where it did.
And we screened a rough cut very close to Sundance, and they loved it.
ITVS.
The broadcast commissioning executives loved it and gave us a big thumbs up.
So they were going to give you committed to give you $150,000, as I understand it.
$150,000, another $50,000 upon submission of the final cut, and more importantly, that broadcast audience.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking with filmmakers Carl Diehl and Tia Lesson about their new documentary, Citizen Coke. They were promised money and distribution from the publicly funded Independent Television Service, or ITVS. But just as they were wrapping up their film about the role of corporate money in politics, their deal began to unravel. They couldn't really figure out what was going on until journalist Jane Mayer of The New Yorker put the pieces together. The problem began not with their film, but another documentary. Alex Gibney, the documentarian, the Academy Award-winning documentarian, he had a film called Park Avenue, Money, Power, and the American Dream. And this is where the trouble begins. David Koch, at this point, is on the board of WNET, which is the PBS channel in New York. He lives on Park Avenue, which was this wealthy building, I think, is the center of Alex Gibney's film. And it's hard to tell. I guess as I read it, the public television world becomes nervous even before Coke has a chance to start complaining.
Yeah, apparently the head of WNET, our public television affiliate here in New York, was livid. You know, he felt very blindsided by the Gibney film. And he actually made changes to the film that no other audience in the country saw.
These are like things at the end with disclaimers or responses.
That's right.
That's what a response.
He included the last word of the film was given to the spokesperson for Coke Industries without Gibney's permission. And he also, they convened a roundtable after the film, but they didn't invite the filmmaker. Apparently, according to Jane Mayer's report in The New Yorker, the president of NET was anticipating a big dollar donation from David Koch.
Millions.
He was trying to cultivate it. Millions.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Seven figure. And so it was really bad timing, you know, from his perspective. And what the president of NET told her is that he immediately called Independent Television Service and threatened to withdraw WNET, the biggest station in the country, from their strand, from their series.
And at what point do you become aware? This is, you know, fall of 2012, so you're well along. You've got your funding, you're pretty happy still. At what point does the happiness fade?
Well, this is actually right after we got to Sundance. So Gibney's film aired about a week earlier. Then the Sundance announcements are made. And then we started to get a bunch of phone calls. And we thought that they actually were interested in giving us more money because they were so happy for us that we got into Sundance. But little do we know, we actually had no idea that all this was percolating over at ITVS and that there was a whole fiasco. We, frankly, we didn't even know that, you know, David Koch had anything to do with PBS.
Right.
Sort of
surprised didn't know
us.
That particular billionaire was in the hen house there, so to speak.
That's right. That's right. I mean, had we known, I don't know.
Well, I don't know. What would you have done? You were sort of $150,000 pregnant with their money at that point.
Well, they called us. They asked us to change the name of the film, even though they'd seen it and they hadn't flagged any issues with that earlier when they saw the rough cut. They told us that the content related to Coke was problematic. And I asked very bluntly, you know, did this have anything to do with the Gibney film that had aired and the controversy around that? And they said, yeah, there was.
So that must have been a terrible feeling.
Oh, God. Heartbreaking.
Yeah.
Well, speaking, you know, if the business of making a film, you know, a lot of the big bills come due at the very end in the post-production. And we were still cutting the film at that time. And so our hearts just sank because all of a sudden, you know, it looked like we were headed towards a big hole in our finishing funds, you know, and in the middle of an imploding partnership.
But it was heartbreaking even more so because we're public television fans and we're viewers and we're, you know, we pledge. It was sort of stunning that here we made a film about powerful people holding sway over our public institutions, our politicians, and the film itself was caught up in the undue influence of these powerful people in public media.
Yeah, you were becoming part of the process that you were trying to portray. Yeah,
exactly.
And how did the dots connect between this guy at WNET and ITVS? And so, you know, how does that become your problem?
They were saying things like, you know, the film in this current climate at PBS is unbroadcastable because of its title, because of its content related to the Copes. We didn't really know what that meant. You know, we said, look, we can pick any title out of the hat, really, but we can't change the title and the content of the film because of your concern about a funder. So tell us what's really going on. Ultimately, you know, it was Jane Mayer in her expose in The New Yorker that helped us connect the dots. I mean, we called her up because we knew she was sort of the expert on the Cokes, and we told her what happened to us. And she made a lot of calls and did thorough reporting and got a lot of people to go on record to tell her what had happened, both to our film and also to Gibney's film.
So at this point, I don't know, I'm actually not clear. Can they revoke the $150,000 or is this the $50,000 that they...
No, this is the whole thing.
And so then explain what you did when you found that you were, I don't know, about $150,000, $200,000 short of where you thought you'd be.
We went for a big drink.
Yeah, okay.
Cried a little bit. No, we went to crowdfunding. We went to Kickstarter. There was such an avalanche of support for us after the Mayer article, and we realized, you know, a lot of folks wanted to do something. In fact, a lot of public television viewers, you know, wanted to transfer their pledges to us instead of their local station. And we said, no, you know, you got to fund your local station because that's what keeps them independent is your money, not and that's what gives you power over these billionaires. But we took to Kickstarter. We had a 30-day campaign, and initially we hoped to raise $75,000, and we got to that point in 3 days. We doubled that, more than doubled that, by the end of the campaign. And more importantly, we got about 3,500 people to back us. They joined our effort to try to get the film out. So it's a happy ending.
A happy ending that includes the theatrical release instead of a public media broadcast through a company called Variance Films. Coming up after a short break, the creators of Citizen Coke address the allegation that the movie they delivered for public television was not the film that they had promised.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive angel clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
Filmmakers Tia Lesson and Carl Diehl say that public television yanked funding for their film, Citizen Coke, after billionaire David Koch objected to another PBS documentary that had portrayed Koch and his brother in an unflattering light. At the time, David Koch sat on the board of New York Public Television station WNET. He's left that position but remains a player in the world of public media as a member of the board of another major station, WGBH, in Boston. We contacted the public television entity that was supposed to fund Citizen Koch, the independent television service, about its decision to drop the project. ITVS directed us to a statement on its website contending that it had acted because early cuts of the film did not reflect the original proposal. Not so, according to filmmakers Lesson and Deal. Now, let me just clarify one point here. They say the film changed. You say clearly it didn't. Would you think it's fair to say that this was, a progressive or liberal film going in, or do you not see it that way?
It was an honest film. It was a film that represented our experience of trying to understand what happened in America in the aftermath of the Supreme Court's ruling in Citizens United.
And let me just add, it's not a partisan film. I mean, first of all, Carl and I are not Democrats or Republicans. We're independents. But this is not a film about that. It's a film about working people and ordinary people, middle-class people, whose voices are being drowned out by those with more money. On top of that, they never raise objections to the political content of the film. They never called into question its accuracy or integrity. All they said was the word Koch, and the content of the Kochs in the film was a problem. So I think that these executives were put in a really difficult position. And they were put in a difficult position because public television accepts these enormous sums from corporate interests and from billionaires. And so this was bound to happen. You know, censorship happens, I think, a lot more than we imagine. But I think people tend not to talk about it.
Tia Lesson and Carl Deal are the filmmakers behind the new documentary Citizen Koch. Thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having us, Kim.
The film is now out in theaters and available for pre-order from the filmmaker's website, citizenkoch.com. Now another story of independent filmmakers looking to market and distribute their movie by squeezing money, in this case, out of potatoes. When husband and wife team Aaron Gaudet and Gita Pulapalli were preparing to make their second film, a small indie drama called Beneath the Harvest Sky, they came up with an unusual plan to distribute and market the movie before one frame was even shot. KCRW producer Jenny Radlett has the story.
The potato chip aisle at the grocery store is probably the last place you'd expect to find marketing for a small independent film. But that's exactly what happened with Beneath the Harvest Sky. This micro-budget indie is about two teenage boys desperate to leave their home in northern Maine. To save money, one toils away all summer on a blue potato farm. The other smuggles drugs across the Canadian border. And inevitably, their friendship comes to a crossroads.
You have no idea what kind of money I can make here.
But this is what I'm
done.
You think you're doing something different. Okay, you think like your dad sees something special in you, you know, but you're not. You're doing exactly what everyone in this town has expected you to do since the day you were born.
This one-of-a-kind marketing campaign was the brainchild of the film's writer-directors, Aaron Gaudet and Gita Pulapalli.
There's not many indie filmmakers going into production that know that at the end of it all, their little indie movie is going to be on bags of potato chips.
Yeah.
We knew that as we were going into production.
So how'd they pull it off? Well, for one thing, they had to start early, like months before they had even shot one frame of the film.
Like any business, you know, if you're going to open a store, you don't start your business and build out your store and get everything done and have your grand opening and open the door and then say, oh, wait, who are my customers?
For indie filmmakers, the most obvious way to get customers is to cast an A-list star.
The reason the A-list star is there is because it's easy. I mean, it really is. It's easy to say, I'm going to put a value on this star and I know what it'll do in the foreign marketplace, or I'll know what it can at least do in box office domestically.
But a bigger star would have also meant a bigger risk and less creative control. So instead, Gita and Aaron tried an experiment. What if they added value to their film in a different way, by partnering with someone who could help them market it to way more people? In order to pull it off, they'd need to find the right person. I mentioned a minute ago that Beneath the Harvest Sky was shot on a blue potato farm. Well, that farm is also the largest supplier for Terra Blue's potato chips.
Those blue potatoes were going to be in the movie with or without Terra because they were, you know, we were shooting our scenes on a blue potato farm, and we had written into our script that it was a farmer harvesting blue potatoes.
Terra Blues are also the official snack of JetBlue Airlines. If Gita and Aaron could score a marketing partnership with Terra, the potential exposure could be huge. 5 months before shooting the film, they sent their script to Terra's New York headquarters.
My first reaction was intrigue. This is not something that comes along very often.
Jared Simon is the director of marketing for Terra Chips.
So we thought right away there was actually a very interesting consumer fit between the independent filmgoer and the person who seeks out Terra Chips.
But there was one potential roadblock, the storyline. Beneath the Harvest Sky is a gritty indie film with a teenage drug mule. Not exactly wholesome fare.
You know, as we started to talk to them, well, what is this film going to be about? What is the content? You know, we started to see it wasn't just a idealistic film about the glories of farming.
On the upshot, it could give them exposure to a younger indie film-going audience. And to sweeten the pot, Gita and Aaron agreed to make a short documentary about the Blue Potato Farm while they were there. Terra agreed and invested about 5 to 10% of their entire annual marketing budget into Beneath the Harvest Sky.
Yeah, it was sort of this, you know, thing that we were joking about on production of just like, you know, as we're making this sort of edgy indie drama, like this is like, you know, Winter's Bone on bags of potato chips. Like it almost felt like too good to be true.
Fast forward 1 year and 3 months. Aaron and Gita brought their finished film and marketing plan to the Toronto Film Festival. Terra came too, handing out free bags of chips and hosting the premiere after party. They all thought landing a distribution deal would be a piece of cake.
Going into Toronto, we felt like there was going to be this response of, wow, like this is innovative, this is crazy, and that wasn't quite how it worked.
We had a list of 10 that we thought really released indie films well, and 9 out of the 10 were not willing to try something new.
Distribution companies were intrigued by the marketing package, but they had a hard time translating it into dollars.
And most of them would say, there's no A-list star, so it's a pass, because we don't really know how we would market it. That was disappointing.
Ultimately, Aaron and Gita signed a deal with Tribeca Films, one of the only distributors who were willing to work with them and Terra Chips to market the movie.
If you talk to any filmmaker, they'll tell you that filmmaking is all about collaboration. So why not keep that collaboration going through distribution? You find a way to collaborate with the distributor as well. So for us, it's still about collaboration right to the very end.
And after almost 4 years of hustling, the end is nearly in sight. Marked bags of Terra Blues are still in grocery store aisles and JetBlue flights across the country. If Gita and Aaron can make their money back, plus a little extra to start their next creative project, that's no small potatoes. For the business, I'm Jenny Radelet.
Beneath the Harvest Sky is available for streaming on platforms including Amazon and iTunes. And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker and Ray Guarna produced and edited today's program. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. While you're there, also be sure to check out KCRW's monthly TV podcast, The Spinoff. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.